number of years ago, I had an appointment that was out sort of in East County, San Diego, and it was later in the afternoon. So I went to the appointment and did what I had to do. And as I was leaving the place where I was, I realized that I, in essence, had two ways to get back home to my house in North Park. One was the sort of like very straight, quickest path, which was to get right on the 8, take it west, get on the 805, and get off right there on University Avenue. The other, I noticed, was exactly the way that I used to come home when I worked at a different church that was out in East County, San Diego, when I was an associate pastor there before I was moved to this church. And sort of there at the intersection, as I was waiting for the light to turn green, deciding if I was going to go the regular way or if I was going to take this way that I had taken probably hundreds and hundreds of times before, every time that I left work from that church and went home, I decided, oh, what the heck? We'll take the other way that I had taken before. Classic example of doing something for old time's sake. I never understood that phrase until that moment. I was like, oh yeah, you just do stuff for the heck of it because you used to do it. That's basically what it means. And I turned left, and as I started going down that road, I got to the church where I had been a pastor for about 10 years, and then I drove the path that I knew so well. I remembered every turn of the road. I remembered sort of even the places that there were large trees and then places without, places where there was really nice views over a little small valley. I remembered the lights that if you beat that light, you would get the bonus of making the next three lights, and the lights that you would just never, ever beat. And as I drove that way, I realized that I was having two feelings. One was a sense of just like absolute familiarity. I knew that route like the back of my hand. I remembered every turn, every twist, all of it. And it was still that way. But the other feeling that I had was a feeling of that things were different, that things were kind of surprising, that they weren't so much familiar as they were just a little bit strange. And I was having both of those feelings as I drove home. But let me clarify that and explain what I mean. It wasn't that I felt so much familiarity, but then when I would see something that was different, then I would feel like it was different and strange, and then I would go back to feeling like it was the same. It's not like these feelings replaced each other in some sort of like consecutive way. I didn't drive and then see like, oh, that's different, that's a new coffee shop, or oh, that's different, they built a fence. It was instead that I had both of those feelings the whole time. Even when it was so, so familiar, it also felt really, really different for some reason. Even when it felt so like I absolutely knew it, it also felt a little bit strange as well. Now, the reasons why it would feel familiar, I probably don't have to share with you. It's obvious. It felt familiar because it was. I had driven that way so many times. I knew it so well, every twist and turn. Why did it feel different, I wondered? Why did it feel strange? Well, as I arrived home, finally then it dawned on me as I had sort of idly processed it as I drove. And I realized it felt different because I was different. That it had been enough years and enough time, enough life experience, that I was, for some very, very real reasons, I was a foundationally different person in some ways than I had been the last time I drove that path. I'd received a lot of clarity, I think, about my call as a pastor. I had figured out some ways to embrace the Christian tradition that I hadn't before. I had a sense of purpose and meaning. And the importance of this really can't be understated. I had really found a place where I felt like I could be me. I had found this church. I'd found this room that felt so right the first time I walked into it. And I'd found a church community that I felt like I could be genuine and authentic with. That's you. And so in a very real sense, yeah, everything was the same, but I was different. Which meant that there was this tension the whole time. there was this tension between what had been and what was now. And I realized that I would never see that route the same way ever again. The old way of driving that path, it was gone forever, because I couldn't go back to being that person that I was before. Which meant no matter how many times I drove that path, in a very real sense, I don't know why I'm giving so many cliches here this morning, I couldn't go home again. That's what they mean. I get it now. I could never go back. It would never feel the same as it had that last time. And it was gone forever. And it was gone because I was different. And I'd never be that person again. And there's this tension sometimes, I think, for us in life. And sometimes we don't notice it until we have changed, and then we come back to something that felt familiar at one point, and it feels different, and you're not sure why, and it's because you're different. There's this tension, I think, about those same things, about the places and things that you can't go back to, about the things that you'll never really see or feel in the same way. It's really running through all of this scripture passage this morning that Luke read for us. In a very real sense, it's kind of the glue that holds it together. It's the foundational question that it asks as it moves through it. What happens in your life of faith? What happens in those times when there are those things and places that you held as familiar, had a certain meaning, and they're gone forever? And you have to make those decisions about who you are now and what you can hold on to. Which I think is really kind of what's happening in this whole passage. And understand the way that this passage unfolds. I love that it starts with this verse. After these things, Jesus showed himself again to the disciples by the Sea of Tiberias, and he showed himself in this way. I love that phrasing. It's like telling the reader and hearer of this passage, this is how he's going to show up. Not just that he did. It's not just going to be the where, when, and why. It's going to be the how that we want you to pay attention to. How Jesus shows up. And what's happened is that throughout the whole Gospel of John, it's told all of his teaching and preaching, his life with the disciples, his conflict with the Roman Empire, his crucifixion and his death, and then his resurrection. On Easter Sunday, we talked about the resurrection account from the book of John, how Mary Magdalene, that disciple, came to the empty tomb and found it empty and then saw Jesus again for the first time, which was the first time that Jesus had been seen after his resurrection to Mary Magdalene. And then it tells us that she went and she told the other disciples, and the other disciples for a little while didn't see him. But then one night they were gathered in a room, it said behind locked door, there's a sense of fear for them. And all of a sudden, Jesus just shows up, it says. Behind closed, locked doors, all of a sudden, he's there. And he experiences the disciples, and he gives them this message of peace, and then he's gone. And then it says, like almost a whole week later, he shows up again. This time with Thomas, who missed the previous one, a verse that we preached a couple of weeks ago, or maybe it was last week. And he shows up, and gives the same message of peace. And then, nothing. It doesn't tell us how long it is until this verse. They don't say it's been a week or a few weeks, but you get the sense that it's been quite a while. And this is something that is really, really kind of understated, I think, about these post-resurrection accounts of Jesus and about what it's like to be a disciple. That nobody really, really spells out that sort of like undercurrent of uncertainty that they must have felt in this time. Because what happens is that Jesus shows up and all of a sudden he's there and he says, peace be with you. And then all of a sudden he's gone. None of the accounts have him saying like, okay, now I'm going to see you next Tuesday. Don't worry. I'm going to come back a total of 5 more times. Nothing like that. He just sort of sporadically or erratically shows up and is gone. Then all of a sudden he's there again, and oh my gosh, and it's this fleeting moment, and then he's gone again. Which means the disciples, if we can put ourselves in their position, they must be so fundamentally decentered in this time. They'd had so much stability with their relationship with Jesus. He came, he found folks like Peter that were fishers, and he would bring them in, and he'd tell them what to do. He'd say, now we're going to go to this town, and we're going to preach to these people. Now I'm going to heal this person, and now we're going to go to Jerusalem. It had all been laid out very, very clearly. There was a certain certainty to it. It was a foundation. They knew what to do. They knew who they were. They knew what was going to happen because they could look to Jesus. But now, after his resurrection, they don't know what to do. He hasn't told them. He hasn't told them, here's what you're going to do after my resurrection. He hasn't told them really what any of this means yet. So all they know is that Jesus is here sometimes and sometimes he's not. But what are we supposed to be doing? It must have been such a fundamentally confusing time for them because they'd been so changed. They'd been so altered by what they'd seen and heard and experienced and knew from all of those years of Jesus. But now what? What do we do? And it's that sort of primary question about what do we do going forward? What does this mean? It really is what's kind of going on in the background of all of this. But Jesus shows up in this way. It says that gathered together were Peter, Thomas, called the twin, two others of his disciples. Peter says to them, I'm going fishing. Now, I don't think that this means that Peter's lost his faith. I don't think this means that Peter is like, oh, I give up, Jesus is gone, I'm just going to go back to what I used to do. I think it's just what Peter knew. He had been a fisher. That's how you got food. That's how you made a living. They didn't know what they were supposed to be doing at this time. No one had said to Peter, you're going to start a thing called the church. Peter was just like, what am I supposed to do? So he does what makes sense. He goes back to what he knows. He goes back to what he remembers. He goes back to the things that felt sort of dependable, that he could rely on. So he's like, I'm going to go fishing. And I love it that Peter doesn't say, hey, does anybody want to go fishing? He's just like, I'm going fishing. I don't know if it was this way, but I picture them all just like sitting in a room. It's just kind of awkward. And Peter's like, well, I'm going fishing, and gets up and leaves. And we know that it's just him because the disciples are like, well, okay, hey, can we go too? Peter's like, yeah, fine, whatever, I'm going fishing, leaves. He's trying to go back to what he knows, what felt dependable. But also it reminds us and shows us just how hard it is to go back once things have changed. You can go back and do the same thing, but it's not always going to work out the same way. As it says, when they went and they got into the boat, they didn't catch anything. There was nothing. The last time they had gone fishing, Jesus was with them. And Jesus was like, cast your net over here. And they're like, oh my gosh, there's so much fish. There's always this abundance with Jesus. But that's not what happens in this moment. They go back and there's nothing. And just after daybreak, which tracks, because to be someone who fishes then is what you do is you go out at night. You hang lanterns over the water, and that attracts bugs. And when the bugs come, fish come, and they try to eat those bugs. That's how you would fish, and then you would pull in the net, which means Peter's fished all night, and so have the other disciples. Yet just after daybreak, it says that Jesus stood on the beach, and they didn't know it was him. How would they? How could they? They're far away from shore. Maybe the light is just now breaking. They're not expecting to see him there. They don't know it's him. And Jesus says this, you don't have any fish, do you? Now, they don't know it's Jesus. I love this texture of this story. You try to fish all night. You don't catch anything. And there's a guy on the shore who's like, you didn't catch anything, did you? They must have been like, yeah, thanks, buddy. And they're like, no. And he's like, I got an idea. Cast the net to the right side of the boat. They're probably like, who is this guy? We got it from here, pal. Thanks a lot. But they do. And they cast the net on the right side of the boat, and it says that they were not able to haul it in because there was so much fish. And then the disciple who Jesus loved, who I think is Lazarus for a very good reason that I can't go into now. Maybe I'll write a book in the next 4 months. Says it's the Lord, because he knows. It's the abundance. It's what they remember from fishing. Not catching nothing, catching too much. Suddenly something is happening and something is really, really different, but it's also the same. And it's this weird sort of mix. And the disciple who Jesus loves, Lazarus, is like, it's Jesus. And when Peter hears this, Luke, thank you for your excellent reading of this verse earlier, for saying what we were all thinking. Peter heard that it was the Lord. He put on some clothes because he was naked and jumped into the sea, which means they were fishing naked. No shame. This is a church of grace. I don't fish a lot. You want to fish naked? I don't know. Maybe it works for you. Go do you. We don't even care. But the weird part is that he gets dressed to swim into the sea. I feel like if I needed to swim well, I would take off everything and then jump in. But he puts it all on. There's no theology to this. It's just a weird part. Just makes you think, yeah, that's probably the way it really happened, because they were like, Peter was naked, but he didn't say anything, and then he put on the stuff, and he jumped in the water, and that's just what happened. Put it in, okay. Gotta tell the truth. The other disciples, though, they come in the boat. Peter's always leading here, even early on. Although he's not yet the leader of the church, he's the one who's like, I'm gonna go fishing, and then I'm gonna go in, and the other disciples are always playing catch up here. The other disciples came in the boat, dragging the net full of fish. They were about 100 yards off. And I love this part. So good. I want each and every one of us to picture this. Picture it the way that you want to, and know that's probably the right way to picture it. I want you to picture this experience, because the texture and the nuance, how it makes you feel, is really, really helpful. Because this is how Jesus showed up. They go on shore, and they see a fire there. Jesus has already taken time to prepare a charcoal fire, and he's already started making them breakfast. And they get on the shore, and they pull the boat in, and Peter comes on, and Jesus is like, sit down. I've made you breakfast. And it's probably cold. Probably still a little dark, and there's the light of the fire, and there's the smell of it cooking, and it's warm. And Jesus says, I also want you to bring some of the fish that you caught, and we'll add it in. And there's room for each and every one of us right there at the fire. There's so many reasons, I think, to love God. Evangelicalism is always like, you love Jesus because he died for you. There's something that makes me really, really love Jesus, because he cooked him breakfast. I love that image. I love the nurturing sense of it. I love the sense that, like, these guys are probably hungry, and they're scared, and they're worried. And what would say what I want to say any better than to just sit down and say, cooked you breakfast. I love a God that will cook me breakfast. Rye toast dry every time. And bring what you brought, pitch in. So Simon Peter, he goes aboard. And this is such a funny part of the story. Remember, it was so full of fish, all of them couldn't put it into the boat. It says that Simon Peter, he went on board and he hauled the net ashore all by himself. Just drags it up, and the net was not torn. And Jesus says to him, come and have breakfast. And nobody says to him, who are you? Because they know. It's not necessary to say, who are you? They know it's him. And Jesus comes and he takes bread, like we will have in a few moments. And he has fish. And he gives them breakfast. This is the third time that he showed up. But he shows up in this way. around a campfire, cooking breakfast, literally a potluck. I brought some, bring what you brought, let's cook it and put it all together, and let's just eat together. And he showed up in this way. And I love this so much. I love it because on one hand, few passages I feel like really sort of like key into that tension of what it's like to live into your faith after the resurrection as much as this one does. And when I say after the resurrection, I don't just mean all of this time that has passed. I mean as people who really, really take the resurrection seriously. People who affirm and celebrate and wrestle with this idea that God has defeated death. That evil and sin will not stand, that it is authentically and genuinely the power of love that will change the world, and no matter how bleak things are seeming, we have hope, because Christ is alive. Empire doesn't win. God is acting and moving, and even making us breakfast. There's a deep tension that you get, I think, in a progressive theology, which I feel like if someone was going to ask me what is a progressive theology, I would say it's people who take the resurrection seriously. It's people who affirm that empire will not have the last word, that death is defeated forever, that Christ is alive, that love is the way, and justice matters. Few passages have named that tension then of what it's like to try and live through your faith after taking all of that seriously. Feeling that tension of this is what I knew and what felt dependable, and then I started taking the resurrection seriously, and suddenly questions became more important than answers. I love that this passage, it doesn't finish with answers. Jesus doesn't say to them, now this is what this is going to mean, and this is how you should understand the resurrection, and this is what your theology is going to be, and here's what I want you to do. He doesn't do any of that. He lets them sit with the questions. And to take the resurrection seriously, to live life after the resurrection, it is to say, I've traded some answers for some questions, but they're really beautiful questions. That'll never steer you wrong. What do we do now? How do we live? What does this all mean? How do I give my life to it? But what I love the most is that the single context for all of those questions and that wrestling, it's a meal. It's breakfast. It's at a campfire. There's no barriers or boundaries. It's just right there on the sand, and you just can walk up and have a seat and bring what you brought, and it's a part of it. It's kind of like the Last Supper. But whereas the Last Supper had this sort of pall over it of death and worry and dread, this meal where he breaks bread and shares it to all of them, it's marked by hope. It's marked by questions. And he doesn't tell them what it's going to mean, but he lets them know he's going to feed them through all of it. He's going to give them sustenance and bread and fish for all of that time because he loves them and he cares for them. It's my deepest hope for us that each and every time that we come and we celebrate communion, we break bread and we remember this, each and every time we recall this meal too. Each and every one of us bringing who we are, the questions that we have, and knowing that Christ again and again meets us in this place. And that is the good meal. Amen.